Welcome to the ACRO Files. Our listeners know that the American College of Real Estate Lawyers is a national organization of 1,000 distinguished practitioners, fostering the exchange of the most sophisticated ideas and experiences in the development, financing, and investment in real estate. We continue our series of podcasts with leading individuals in commercial real estate who have built the companies that have shaped the industries to share their reflections on their careers and predictions for the future. Today, I am so pleased to welcome my good friend, Mark Rose, CEO of Avison Young, a global real estate advisor with 5,000 employees in more than 100 offices in 20 countries. Mark, thanks for joining me today.
My pleasure, Jay. Thank you for having me.
So before we start to chat about this amazing company that you've built and other things in your career, I always like to sort of start at the beginning and tell us a little bit about where you grew up, what influenced you to get involved in real estate, and we'll talk about how you got to AY through our friends at JLL and other places.
Sure. Well, I think all throughout this conversation, I think we're going to be talking about acceleration and mentoring, and those have been prominent words and labels in my life. So I did start out early. I was in university, went to Queens College, part of the City University of New York system at 16. So I stayed local, born and raised in Queens, and, was out at 20 going into public accounting in New York City. And I happened to have picked a smaller firm over a larger firm that spent a lot of time with New York real estate clients, including the Helmsleys, which was my largest client. And the individual that hired me on campus at Queens was also a Queens graduate, brought to public accounting, and he and another partner, were very good to me to mentor me. And so right around 23 years old, I was getting married actually in that year. And I was recruited over with a partner in my public accounting firm who was moving over to become the CFO for the British Coal Pension Funds REIT in the US. And I joined them. So it was a very Queens, New York centric beginning, Jay.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't realize that that's where your roots were, because you've been obviously lots of other interesting places. So you started working for this pension fund that was investing in deals in the U.S., acquiring properties. What were they doing back then?
Yeah, so it was actually it was the Continental Illinois Property REIT that was formed out of the same folks that did a Continental Illinois Bank and also Realty and Mortgage of the Pacific, and it was pulled together. And at the time, it was one of the largest equity REITs, and it was owned through a nominee corp by the pensioners of the people who went into the mines in the UK, to work on and pull out coal. And, I came in 1987, as I said, at 20, I was almost 24, but I was still 23. And, we were in the process of taking the partially public REIT, fully public. And there was that teeny weeny little Monday crash that happened in October of 1987, which again, at the time was awful, but it turned out to be one of the bigger influences and moments in my career, because we went into asset management mode after writing off an awful lot of expenses and cutting checks because, we had to push off that offering. And, as I said, went to asset management mode, figured out that we had $1 billion REIT yielding about 3%, needing $50 million of CapEx. But at the same time, if the money was repatriated back to the UK, the gilt was trading risk-free at 14%. So one asked the question, as only somebody younger can, why do you own this? It just doesn't make any sense. And with my mentor, James Boisi, who had just left as the vice chair of Morgan Guarantee and had moved over to work with his friend, Harry Helmsley at Helmsley Enterprises, he is our chairman. We sat down and we wrote that they shouldn't. And we presented that in late 1988, and by 1989, in a tough situation because the woman who was the CEO and kind of did the official hiring, great lady, but she really didn't want the company sold. She wanted to put debt on in 1989. And the strategy that we had written was things were starting to look very frothy. But again, frothy or not, we were looking and facing 3% yields with a need for CapEx against 14 risk-free. And that doesn't make any sense when you're supposed to be performing for your ultimate beneficiaries, in this case, the pensioners. And so, for lack of a better term, I won the job and became a 26-year-old CEO of a public REIT. And went on to sell off the retail portion of it, the regional malls in California at a 4 cap, and then sold the office portfolio for about a 5 cap. Then the last asset, that last major asset, was the one that brought me to Washington, D.C., which was the Watergate, and finished all of that off in the early 90s. And the British Coal Pension Fund nominee corp became one of the best performing asset managers and investment managers in real estate in all of Europe because they had limited to no exposure to U.S. real estate.
Wow. So you somehow managed to then transition, I assume, because I think that's about when we met, over to JLL, or maybe when it was Jones Lang Wooten even. I mean, how did that occur?
So right after I finished the last part of the sale, because there were still, we had almond farms, we had partnerships, we had kind of pieces of, because I broke up the Watergate into pieces, and in 1993 started my own company called Metropolitan Realty Advisors, and headquartered it at the Watergate. I was always supposed to return to New York, but we had our first child, and we loved the D.C. area, so we stayed. And that led to forming this company. But I really realized I was not a small company person. So in 1995, I sold my company, Metropolitan Realty Advisors, to JLW, became one of the six partners of the US business. And then through all the machinations of what happens when you merge companies, really became the lead for JLW in the merger on March 11th, 1999, from the US side, for JLW.
That night, that's the merger with LaSalle Partners, or not
Right.
LaSalle, but right. So you
Yeah.
did JLL, right? So you were in Washington, as you don't need me to tell you, a very interesting time. Lots of ups and downs in that decade, and
Yes.
the cyclical nature of our business, continues, right? What as you look back then, I mean, when you mentioned cap rates in the fours, right? Back then, I don't know that there's many people that listen to this that will be remember those numbers, except in the more recent round. Most people think cap rates were much higher back then when we were younger. So what how did that, what was the transition, and how were we at those kinds of cap rates? I remember when cap rates were really simple at one point when they were 10. So it was very easy to, figure out what values were. What's your perspective on that, since you've really seen the cycle on all sides?
Yeah, well, and especially 41 years into this, our industry is cyclical. And as I've said many times on many panels over the last decade or so, I'm only surprised that people are surprised. But we are cyclical. And we were at a top in 1988, 1989. And as young as I was, you saw it, you felt it, you knew it. By the way, I would say, not being experienced enough to bring their exact money back in 1994 comes with not having all of the experience, because the other part of the cycle, you can sell everything off, but you need to know when to bring it back. Now, again, later on, you learn how to do that as well. But Jay, we are a cyclical industry, and it made all the sense in the world to sell at the top. We knew it was the top. I will tell you, we're not going to name the names of the individuals who bought my assets, but they were telling me that they stole it from me, dumb kid, all of those things. And many of them were no longer employed shortly after the purchases. And we were a top performing pension fund in the UK after, after doing all of that. So it really goes back to what are you doing? Why are you doing it? What is the outcome you're looking for? And what, and what's the strategy? And then I'll say this over and over again, you cannot underestimate the impact, or in this case, over maybe overestimate the impact of having a mentor, somebody who you can bounce these ideas off of. Because, as I said with Jim, who a few years ago, passed away in his 90s, but I would tell him and knew early on that he had forgotten more than I knew. And if you can embrace the listening piece and the analytical piece, and if you do what's right for your ultimate stakeholder, really good things happen.
So I agree with all that. Talk a little bit more about how the cyclicality, right, of the industry has changed over the years, right? How we, if you think about post the GFC, where we were in this long upcycle and everybody was waiting and waiting. Whereas back then the cycles, seemed to happen a little bit more predictably and perhaps quickly.
So as you got into the late 80s and early 90s, actually worked on an analysis back then that since World War II, right through the early 90s, there were pretty normalized 14-year cycles. There was always interruption through policy changes, tax changes, the 86 Tax Act, things that happened in 80 with Reagan coming in. There were, they're just influences, but it was relatively stable of 14-year cycles. Then they started to level out a little bit. And now we see them move quicker, right? So everyone looked at the GFC. Again, from our vantage point, things were unbelievable in 2007. 2008, you start to see some pain. 2009, it was brutal. In Toronto and Miami in 2010, you were already back to the same volumes and higher pricing. And this latest one, which I will go down, living through 1990 through 1994 as well, and the RTC issue and savings and loan bailouts. This one is the worst of them. Because this is the first time that the federal government or the Federal Reserve didn't work with the industry to help it out. And, we've been starved of debt capital. And this is an industry that thrives, survives on debt capital. And obviously, that has been very difficult. So, this one's been a little different. You had two black swans back to back, first COVID. You're coming out of COVID and you really have a debt crisis. Now, 3.5 years ago, I gave a number of interviews, and this was in the Globe and Mail, who I just met with recently, were kind of against the good feelings of our clients, said it takes about 5 years. And the sad example we had was, with 9/11, the tragedy on September 11th. And for 2 years, we were investing in security, but nobody wanted to come back into New York City. Nobody wanted to go into named buildings. No one wanted to go into high rises. But in the third year, people started to dip their toe. In the fourth year, it got better. The fifth year, it was better, and we were kind of off to the races. Having stated that in numerous interviews, if, 3 years ago, that this would follow, it is exactly tracking. And the head real estate writer of the Globe and Mail in Canada actually asked me, she said, I listened to you and you said this, and none of us were with you, but this is exactly what's happening, which is, listen, we needed to get through COVID, then you needed 2 years past COVID, and you would start to see people dip their toes in the water. Through our Avison Young Business Index, we are tracking cell phone data and our proprietary data that sees every day there's another person coming in, another person coming in, and another person coming in. Every day people are getting a little more comfortable, a little more comfortable. And there are things out there. For example, the tariff question over the last week could have been an impediment to recovery. If we start to see inflation again, it could be an impediment to recovery. But we are on track to have a five-year incremental recovery where 2025 are the incremental gains. And if you're looking for quote unquote a recovery, they sit in 26, no later than 27. And it's analytics and data that back this as much as it is experience. It's not just throwing something against the wall.
I just want to follow up with one question before we pivot to something else. So when you're comfortable, obviously, in making those predictions based on analytics, as you said, right? But you are in a lot of different places. So you see a lot of different situations, I think. You know, New York, in my humble view, right, is really different feeling than Washington and even Chicago. And Chicago's better than Washington, right? And Toronto, which is a fabulously strong real estate market, as you well know, and London, you know, those are different places. So when do you think that this five-year recovery, 5 to 7 year recovery, to be fair, right, comes into its culmination at different times in different places? Or are you talking about a national recovery, or is it driven by a half a dozen of the key tier one cities?
So I have been global for a very, very, very long time. And more importantly, when you discuss real estate, culturally and subculturally, one size does not fit all. So Jay, you definitely have the New Yorks of the world are doing extremely well. The southern part of the U.S. is doing well. Quite frankly, the western part, you know, Canada is doing better. Toronto's always going to be solid, but its return to office is slower than other places.
Oh, interesting.
London, we have the EPC regulations, which started that in 2023. If your project, you know, now the ratings are A through H. If you're a G or an H, you can't let your buildings. By 2030, if you're not an A or B, you can't let your buildings. So there's so much product that's being taken out of commission to start the retrofits to get up to speed for sustainability, you know, and for carbon neutrality, that city acts a little different. Central and Eastern Europe acts a little bit different. South Africa, which we are in, Israel, which we're in, Vietnam and Korea, they're all different. And so I can't tell you that every city in every product type moves at the same pace, because they don't. And to just mention that as well, obviously, data centers right now are the favorite asset class. Affordable housing, if we can make it pencil out, could go for the next several decades. Office, I think, is one of the assets to be watching, because it has been beaten up and now there's the opportunity because it is turning around. Retail, grocery anchored has been killing it, been a favorite asset class. Retail malls, less so. Hotels, less so. Outdoor storage, amazing. Cold storage, amazing. So product by product, and obviously I left that industrial, which did very well. It's going to be fine. It, you know, we just built too much of it over the last couple of years, but it's going to be fine. Not every city and not every product moves at the same pace. But what we know today, and this is non-political, but LA, San Francisco, Portland, Seattle, Chicago, Baltimore, Atlanta are struggling with cities that have a number of attributes that are not allowing it. Washington, D.C. is different, right? It's lost all this tax revenue from particularly the federal employees not coming back, right? Even though we asked the previous administration to ask them to come back. Obviously, this one is, and we'll see what happens. But where there have been policies that people can stay home, where there have been policies that you favor all social programming over kind of an equivalent and a balanced amount of policy that helps businesses, stay afloat, there are problems there. And said a little differently, in almost every one of the cities that we mentioned, there's a problem with understanding the rule of law and there's a problem with safety. And we have the surveys of people saying, listen, no, I'd love to sidestep a commute, but my big issue is I don't feel comfortable. And so reestablishing at least a base level of a rule of law for a certain number, and they're mostly northern cities, that's something that we have to track. And they will lose out to the southern states and the southern cities. And clearly, Brooklyn, Manhattan had just done extremely well.
Right. You interested, one of the really interesting statistics, you may not know this, was cited last 2 weeks ago at the roundtable, was when they were talking about some of those cities, particularly San Francisco, which has truly struggled, right? They said that, I can't remember who reported this, I think the number was 80%. 80% of the AI dollars go to San Francisco. So theory being that should get the San Francisco market recovering much faster than a lot of other markets, and much faster than it's been the last, year or two, as people are very concerned, as you say, about safety and other issues downtown.
Listen, I flew back to Chicago. It's a city, that I live in as well. And, I walked around the last couple of days. The sheer number of retail spaces downtown that are vacant, which means they're boarded, which means they're dark. And San Francisco, AI dollars or not, 40% vacancy and boarded up first floors, that needs to change.
Right. No, that's the problem in Washington. Street retail is vacant, and the offices, because of the government and the private sector too, but the offices, people just have not returned to their work offices. They're working from home. So I do want to talk some more about this, but I also want to give you a chance to talk about this amazing company that you've built after your great run at JLL and your pause for a little bit at Grubb & Ellis. You went to a company that I think lots of people in the US, at least, right, hadn't heard of. Avison and Young, who's that, right? And it was a much smaller company, obviously, when you went over there. So tell us a little bit about how that, occurred and the transformation. And you've talked to me about your vision for the company and this amazing job you've done in building this global powerhouse.
Well, it's interesting because there's a little bit of a tie to Grubb & Ellis, right? Having gone to Grubb & Ellis in 2005, put it back on the New York Stock Exchange, raised $100 million, to start to grow it, added several hundred brokers, and in other business units. It made sense to sell in 2007, which we did. We were very successful, at various times in only the 2.5 years that I was there. The stock price went from four all the way to 17, got the company sold. And Avison Young was actually the Canadian affiliate, to Grubb & Ellis. But that's not really the connection, because selling Grubb in 2007, I went to Canada to give my last strategy speech to the Avison Young partners in 2008, in January, in Edmonton, and I kid you not, it was minus 40 Celsius. Got a Starbucks, was walking down the street, and the drink froze before I got back to the hotel. And said, you guys can do so many things, but you were provincial companies. At the time, there were 293 people, 53, actually 52, I was the 53rd. So 52 partners, mostly white men, 99% brokerage, headquartered in each of the provinces, and said, if you came together, some wonderful things can happen. And at that speech, they asked me if I would take over. since in theory, I had nothing to do at that moment, and said, no, no, that it's just not what I do. I do build, but I'm not sure I build with with 293 people. And then I took about 17 trips around the world, met with clients, met with friends who were different investors, again, in my listening tour. And we were in 2008 and starting to see some of the problems that were starting to arise, that led to the GFC. And a friend of mine said, I wouldn't start with a brand new company or your company. I would start with something. And when we did the research, different friends, really, but I wrote a strategy that took about 9 months and said, I want it to be private because every one of the global peers are public. I want it to be truly international, so it's going to be headquartered anywhere other than the US. You want the people who are doing the work to be the beneficiaries of the gain, in building if they're going to put the hard work in there. And we want to be able to set the basic ground rules of a culture-based business that our belief in honesty, integrity, and behavior, friendship and family, still appreciates that as you grow around the world, that you have to allow subcultures of the world to rise up to their fullest. And after looking at a few, and I was offered some US space companies and said, no, it's not on strategy. Spoke to the senior leaders at Grubb and Ellis, and we agreed that I would join if I could get the provincial companies to merge, because they had been trying for about a decade. So I joined the middle of June 2008. We had the deal struck July 27, 2008, and merged the companies on October 1st of 2008. So those 293 people then expanded into the US and expanded into the 20 countries. So now we're over 5,000 people. The 53 partners, including myself at that time, are now 700 partners. And the revenues went from $40 million to $1.3 billion. So, but it's based on people working together, advising clients on solutions and outcomes. We're big fans of technology, not to be IPO'd, but to augment and build. We're one of the companies that since we started in this form in 2008, because Avis & Young actually dates back to 1978, with Graham Young in Edmonton. But in 2008, we were able to effectively start the company as a new co. And all of our systems from day one were put on the cloud. And that means the 30 odd applications that are at the foundation of the company have all been on the cloud. They're all using AI. But augmenting what we do, not replacing people.
And look, you it's an amazing story, because I remember when you went up there and started it, and how small and regional it was, and watched it grow as you and I have talked over the years. You've seen in the industry, right, lots of consolidation. So we're down to a handful, right, of major national and international, not just brokers, but consultants, real estate consulting brokerage firms, right? Plenty of capable people in all these great places, right? How do you, what's your message to your people and externally about how you distinguish yourselves when you are, everybody's competing for the same business?
Yeah. So first things first, our principles have financial, operational, and reputational accountability. It's their company. And that allows you to take the traditional pyramid and turn it more into a circle where a client can be in the middle and you're bringing the resources of all of your people, because at the end of the day, those 700 voting principals, plus we have employee ownership, so there's another 500 or more employee owners who are spending every day trying to work together, to solve the needs, which is very, very different from, the competition. Now, to be clear, I only have good things to say about our competition. They're good companies. I'm a fan of Bob Sulentic. I'm a fan of Christian Ulbrich. And those are the two largest. And there are things that, one of those I helped build, right? So, I think they've done a great job. Back on March 11th, 1999, when we merged and created JLL, each of those companies had about a $350 million market cap. One's up at $38 billion, and the other one's at 12. By the way, there's never supposed to be that sort of discrepancy, but there is. With that said, it's fantastic growth. And those companies perform the way, and particularly with CB, Bob does such a great job. He knows who he is. He knows who his company is. They're a public company, and they take care of their public shareholders. That's what they're there for, and they have scale to do a lot of things. That's great. We think there are some different things that you need to do, and what we impress upon them is we want analytics supporting our people. We want to turn, instead of order takers and kind of young people that key in data, we want the interpretation of the business elements of business. And where we have the fair chance, and we do in many times, you take a look at, there's just major accounts, around the world that, that we have compete, that we have competed and won against, the same companies. Where you want to know what a solution is, what an outcome is, and the advice comes first, we will win. And that's, and that's where we focus. And, Jay, it's not as if we can't put the hundreds and thousands of people to deal with the facility management business or project management. We love those businesses. We just love when we can solve people's problems. And that has been really, really helpful because we can back it up.
Okay, good. So I used to think that I recruited a lot of professionals and lawyers around the world, but you obviously dwarf, the kinds of recruiting that we did at DLA, particularly in real estate. And you've seen lots and lots of, and recruited lots of qualified people. You've worked with lots of outside advisors on the legal side and otherwise. To tell this audience, what do you think are the strongest attributes? What does it take to be a really strong consultant advisor in the real estate space?
So the best of the best put the client first and themselves second. They work together in a team, and they spend a little less time on their own recognition and their own compensation. And my mentor was so right. One of the things he told me as a very young man is your job is to make people better than you. Because when you do that, they will make you better than you could have ever been. And so I have been blessed by that, those relationships. It wasn't just him. Have built great teams all the way through. Have watched people. I've got 14 active mentees usually at any time. Many of those, were able to take on the senior roles of many of my competitors, which, I was thrilled to do and help them with that. And when you find not just selfless people, but people who will engage, people who understand being inclusive, and are willing to take the risk of teaching somebody who may do better than them. Again, it rarely happens, because you find yourself outworking or you find yourself being recognized because you help other people. Those are the folks that I look for. It's funny. I've seen companies and been in companies. Some of our competitors, I know the inner workings of all of them, that they're looking for athletes or they're looking for team sports people. And again, that's an attribute of an individual that might succeed if, in fact, what they believe in is working together to produce at the point of sale through execution, through outcome. And so those are the people that we are looking for. The other thing that we're looking for, and despite any political connotation to three letters for words that I never thought they should ever have three letters. Right, it started with LEEDs, with LEED buildings,
Lead,
which quite
yeah.
frankly could very well have just been called best managed buildings, sustainable buildings, all the way through the two words with three letters. We believe that you search for the best and the brightest, and sometimes they never went to college. Sometimes they're sitting in a place that most people won't look. Many times they're sitting in underrepresented, groups. And what we want is the best and brightest, and you actually have to look for them. So that's how we've created the most diverse management team in the industry. Our company is over 45% women. Our businesses are run by women, by people of color. I was the first male CEO ally to Crew, the first one to sign the pledge. We work with the Real Estate Executive Council. All the things you need to do to cast your net wide, because best is best. And I absolutely agree with that. By the way, I'll invoke one little comment. Merit-based, I have no problems with that. But you have to cast that net very wide to find the best in the first place.
Right. So you've talked, I mean, we're not going to have enough time to talk about all your interesting presentations and things you saw in Davos, that did in Davos last week, 2 weeks ago. But you've talked a lot about, you mentioned it, on technology, data-driven analytics, all those things that are influencing not just real estate, but the business world. How do you think, if you look down the, in your crystal ball here, what do you think will look different in the real estate industry in 5 years?
Yeah. So again, I had some great conversations with some of the most respected, successful senior folks, particularly at the Real Estate Governors meeting. But I had the great honor. You're rarely asked to speak once. I had an opportunity to speak four times in Davos and had conversations with Fortune 50 CEOs and chairmen to investors, talking about cities in the public sector to the private sector. And everything is changing, but that doesn't mean you have to engage in any sort of revolution. So here's what I'm talking about. Right now, we have five generations working for the first time, right? Just gave a speech with the CEO of EY. It was 400,000 people, and our panel was about Gen Z and their impact on the world, and I spoke about the built environment. The next 5 to 7 years, the decision makers who we've been working with for a long time aren't going to be there anymore. And there's going to be a major change in who's making decisions, how they're making decisions, who is helping them with those decisions, and that comes back to us. And that means that instead of broker opinion of values and PowerPoints, empirical data that you can pull up 24/7 real time to investment committees is now going to be the standard, right? Predicting that, and we're dangerously close working with the technology that we're building to pick the date and time and reason why you should sell a property at a price. That's going to be part of the future. And then you interpret whether those algorithms are right. This will all be part of what we're doing next. Now, this doesn't eliminate people. It changes input and production to analyzing and interpreting. And then you still need people to execute. We have seen too many times, particularly over the last 20 years, the use of technology. People understand that it can make them better, but what they really have in their back of the back of their minds, because they once saw the dot-com era. Can I get a piece of that, and can we IPO it for $1 billion more? it's just not the way to look at it. If we build and improve our service delivery, if we improve our channels and our data, we become better service providers. And on the investment side, or on the, you know, the occupancy side, we make better decisions, we make better investments. We're going to see more and more of that. I don't think we're going to see people flooding out of the industry. I think we're going to see people change how they approach the industry.
Okay. I want to be sensitive to your time and how busy you are. So let me just close. Let me ask you one last question. You've seen a lot, right? From Queens to from Queens, New York, probably to Queens, New Zealand, and every place else, right? So you have great perspective with great success. What would your advice be to yourself, to your 25-year-old self now, giving everything you've seen? If you knew what you were going to see, what would you be telling yourself back 40 or so years ago?
So it's a great question, and it makes a ton of sense to ask and answer that question, especially with what's gone on over the last 3 days. At 25, you're not quite in control of your emotional intelligence. You're getting there, some better than others. And you know, I was married early, had kids early, so you have a little bit of a head start. But the perfect example was what happened with the announcement of the tariffs, particularly to Canada. Right, so we have operations in Canada and Mexico. And for all the right reasons, our Canadian partners, clients, the business, emotionally impacted, not just disturbed, angry, disrespected, and immediately moved to the negative impact of these tariffs on the business. And one of the things that you learn and you just wish you could learn sooner is to say, take that step back, breathe. Because, for example, what this president wants is an outcome. And tariffs were really just a means to get to an end. And you almost knew, and we had this conversation, Saturday and Sunday were filled with calls and emails and texts and emotions and anger, and said, we could literally on Monday, this could be over. No, it's all, you know, it's all in, you know, happening. And you and I are, again, really blessed. We've got people like Jeff DeBoer, who got on the phone with us yesterday, along with Michael Brooks, who runs the Canadian equivalent at RealPak. Yesterday, we had the talk. And literally, as we're talking, President Trump, Prime Minister, you know, Trudeau met, and they were postponed. The tariffs were postponed because, in essence, the president received what he was looking for. That emotional intelligence still to this very day for everybody. Things that are in your control, worry about them. Things that are out of your control, you can feel bad about them, but they're, by definition, they're out of your control. Take that step back, think, analyze, get your data, then make your best decision. Sometimes you're going to be right, and sometimes you're going to be wrong. And if you're wrong, try not to make that sort of decision again. But those are the things. It's really behavior. I love this industry. I am blessed. I wake up every day. I love doing what I do. I love being in this industry every day for all these years, for all these decades. And the best part about it is right now you take the day-to-day a little less seriously and focus on what's the strategy and what are the outcomes, what's in the best interest of your clients and your people, and you usually make really good decisions.
Great. Mark, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much for your time and your insights on this great path that you have traveled and shared with us. And I know our listeners will be very appreciative of your thoughts.
Always a pleasure. Jay, thank you very much. You're awesome.